Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
One of the world's greatest masterpieces of antique statuary, a piece that has inspired artists of all ages, goes on special exhibit in the Vatican Museums. The Laocoon, 500 years in the Vatican. And UNESCO awards a prestigious prize for the promotion of tolerance and nonviolence to a leading Tamil for his work towards peace in Sri Lanka. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Those are the stories we'll be looking at over the next half hour. Thanks for joining me. It was a chilly January day in 1506 when a farmer working out in his vineyard near the Roman Colosseum fell down into a cavernous hole. What he found buried there turned out to be one of the most treasured masterpieces in the entire history of the world's art, the Laocoon, and for nearly half a millennium it has belonged to the Vatican Museums.
A certain Felice de Fredis went out to his garden on that day in 1506 and fell into a hole. And when he looked up, he saw the Laocoon.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath is a chief curator at the Vatican Museums. He says what Felice saw was an almost life-sized ancient sculptural group of a father and his sons trying to free themselves from deadly snakes. The farmer fell into the hole on the Opio Hill, or Colle Opio, a 350-acre area which once bore the luxurious palaces, villas, and pavilions of ancient Rome, many built by the Emperor Nero before his death in 68 AD.
In antiquity, there was just the Golden House of Nero. So it is an area which has no geology. It's all foundations and holes and whatnot. That's where they sheltered the Laocoon from the barbarians when they conquered Rome. That's where it was forgotten, and that's where this man fell into a hole on the 14th of January.
E subito tutti i cittadini, tutte le persone di una certa cultura si recarono sul posto. Le cronache del tempo dicevano pare un giubileo, tutti i cardinali soiti a vedere proprio in
The director of the Vatican Museums, Francesco Buranelli, says the momentous discovery caused such a stir that Pope Julius II soon heard of it and sent two of his most trusted artists to examine the sculpture. The architect Giuliano di San Gallo and Michelangelo, who just happened to be having tea together that day.
He sent his architect Giuliano di San Gallo when he heard from the rumors that something important had happened downtown. And Giuliano di San Gallo had Michelangelo for tea or something, so he asked him to come along. They both got on their horse with the little son of Giuliano's sitting behind. And he, about 60 years later, describes that whole story, how they go to the Colle Opio and how they look down into that hole. And then he claims that his father said the famous sentence, "This is the Laocoon," which Pliny describes.
Pliny was the first century Roman historian who first wrote of the existence of a marvelous work of sculpture depicting a writhing Laocoon and his sons in the grips of sea serpents. It was a composition he called superior to any painting and any bronze, carved from a single block by eminent Greek craftsmen. But for centuries, all trace of this incredibly intricate statue was lost, that is, until January 14, 1506. Soon after its discovery, Pope Julius acquired the Laocoon, which, along with a collection of other sculptures, formed the beginning of the Vatican Museums. In fact, Julius began a five-century-long tradition. The popes were among the first sovereigns who opened their art collections of their palaces to the public, promoting knowledge of art history and culture. But where does the Laocoon image and the story come from? Some decades before Christ was born, the Latin poet and philosopher Virgil wrote about the Laocoon, a Trojan priest, in his 12-book epic poem, The Aeneid. In it, he tells the story of the Trojan horse, constructed by Greek soldiers to trick the city of Troy into letting them sneak within its walls for a crippling attack.
The sides were planked with pine. They feigned it made for their return, and this the vow they paid. Thus they pretend. But in the hollow side, selected numbers of their soldiers hide. With inward arms the dire machine they load, and iron bowels stuff the dark abode.
But Laocoon was wise to their wicked plan and rushed to warn his fellow citizens.
Laocoon, followed by a numerous crowd, ran from the fort and cried from far aloud, "O wretched countrymen, what fury reigns? What more than madness has possessed your brains? Think you the Grecians from your coasts are gone? And are Ulysses' arts no better known? This hollow fabric either must enclose within its blind recess our secret foes, or 'tis an engine raised above the town to o'erlook the walls and then to batter down. Somewhat is sure design, by fraud or force. Trust not their presence, nor admit the horse."
To prove his point, Laocoon thrusts his spear into the belly of the horse, but still the people of Troy do not believe the danger that awaits them. Then a horrifying scene unfolds, which the people of Troy take to be divine and terrible punishment meted out to Laocoon for defying the gods.
Laocoon, Neptune's priest by lot that year, with solemn pomp then sacrificed a steer. When dreadful to behold, from sea we spied two serpents, ranked abreast, the seas divide, and smoothly sweep along the swelling tide. Their flaming crests above the waves they show, their bellies seem to burn the seas below. Their speckled tails advance to steer their course, and on the sounding shore the flying billows force. And now the strand, and now the plain they held, their ardent eyes with bloody streaks were filled, their nimble tongues they brandished as they came, and licked their hissing jaws that sputtered flame. We fled amazed, their destined way they take, and to Laocoon and his children make, and first around the tender boys they wind, then with their sharpened fangs their limbs and bodies grind. The wretched father, running to their aid with pious haste, but vain, they next invade. Twice round his waist their winding volumes rolled, and twice about his gasping throat they fold. The priest, thus doubly choked, their crests divide, and towering o'er his head in triumph ride. With both his hands he labors at the knots,
his holy fillets the blue venom blots. His roaring fills the flitting air around. Thus, when an ox receives a glancing wound, he breaks the bands, the fatal altar flies, and with loud bellowings breaks the yielding skies. Their tasks performed, the serpents quit their prey, and to the Tower of Pallas make their way.
With Laocoon's horrific demise, the rest, of course, is history. The people of Troy accept their gift horse, bringing it and their own doom into their city gates. And while it does capture the sweeping drama, the Vatican's Laocoon statue may not be a faithful depiction of Virgil's epic story. In fact, it may give room for hope that at least one of the unlucky threesome survives.
There are in antiquity, of course, various versions of the story. One version actually says that not all three were killed, but that one of the sons, the elder son, escaped, and maybe the statue in the Vatican is not based on Virgil's version of the story, but on the version that describes how the elder son, who is not sitting on the altar, who is only entwined in one or two parts of the snake, and he may actually get away, and it may be precisely that story.
The boy, in fact, looks indeed like he may soon free himself from the snake looped around his foot and shoulder. But whichever legend inspired its artists, the Laocoon in the Vatican soon became an icon for artists, writers, and poets, who, from the 16th century on, have come to see it and draw upon its swirling, contorted forms and vivid expressions of fear, grief, and pain for inspiration.
Once you're in front of what's considered already by the ancients as the greatest work of art, as an artist, and also as anybody in the art world, that is a great challenge. And that is what these artists felt, what stimulated them, and what then also stimulated artistic theory. People like Winckelmann, Lessing, Goethe, they all wrote about the statue. Writers like Charles Dickens quoted him. So
William Blake.
Almost every artist had some kind of a reaction, positive or even negative, to the Laocoon. If you think of El Greco, he quite explicitly wanted to invent a picture which showed that he knew the Laocoon but was doing something creative himself.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath, curator at the Vatican Museums. We also heard from the director of the Vatican Museums, Francesco Buranelli. The Laocoon exhibit in the Vatican Museums contains more than 100 works of art, many on loan from some of the world's most prestigious museums, including the Metropolitan in New York, the Louvre, and the Hermitage, among others.
It's a unique opportunity to juxtapose the Laocoon with Primaticcio's replica from Fontainebleau. We've been able to get a statue of the same theme, which was done before the Laocoon was discovered, from Dresden in Germany by Francesco Di Giorgio Martini, one of the greatest 15th century artists. We have the little plaque by Moderno from Vienna, which is one of the first adaptations of the Laocoon, where a Christ in a flagellation is modeled on the pose of the Laocoon. So these are the wonderful pieces that we have in the exhibition around the original statue and that in some way are related to it. Of course, we have the great names here. We have a drawing by Raphael, we have drawings by Rubens, we have a drawing by Bernini.
Didn't I also see a bust, a marble bust?
By Bernini, yes. Attributed to him. We have a model by Osip Zadkin for the monument for the destruction of Rotterdam. So down to the contemporary art, we have reactions to the Laocoon in this exhibition.
It includes bronze casts, copies and models based on the Laocoon, manuscripts, prints, paintings, and exquisite porcelain sculptures. But you'll have to hurry to see it. The exhibit is being held for a limited time only through February 28th. Thursday, November 16th marks World Day for Tolerance. UNESCO, the UN's educational, scientific, and cultural agency, celebrated the day by awarding a special prize for the promotion of tolerance and nonviolence to a leading moderate Tamil in Sri Lanka, Veera Singham Anada Sangari. But how well are the voices of tolerance and nonviolence standing up against extremism in Sri Lanka, or violence between government forces and the LTTE Tamil Tiger militants, has seen a dramatic upsurge in recent weeks, despite an official ceasefire? My colleague Susie Hodges spoke to Mr. Anada Sangari to find out more.
I was really delighted, no, because this is a thing I never expected. I was doing my duty on my own without any expectation. I was really surprised.
This prize has been awarded for tolerance and non-violence. Why do you think these are such important qualities in today's world, and particularly vis-a-vis the ethnic conflict in your homeland?
Actually, it is intolerance that has led to so much trouble. If people had been tolerant, things would have been entirely different. So certainly in a situation like this, tolerance and non-violence is very, very important.
Do you think our world is becoming increasingly intolerant in some ways, that we're becoming more polarized and less ready to accept the views of others who perhaps don't share our ethnicity or our religion?
Yeah, the intolerance is increasing day by day. Especially if you compare today with about a period 3 years back. It had increased severalfold. There was absolute peace also before the CFA was signed. After the ceasefire agreement was signed, you see the LTTE had taken the upper hand and violence started increasing. And today, it has now become violence, then retaliation, then again retaliation. We don't know who started it first, you see. But unfortunately, retaliatory steps are too frequent that violence is increasing at a very high rate.
And do you think perhaps the different religions in your homeland could perhaps be doing more to not only have interreligious dialogue, but to preach the virtue of tolerance?
All our religions are preaching non-violence. And all the religious leaders also have got together and they have formed a front also to promote non-violence and peace. All our religions are united and they are all fighting for peace.
The violence in Sri Lanka has really escalated in recent weeks. And although in theory there is still the ceasefire, it's almost like there were a civil war in all but name. Do you agree?
Yes, certainly. After the ceasefire, the violence escalated little by little. And now it has gone to the point of civilians getting killed in large numbers.
And how hopeful are you that this fighting can be contained, that it won't further escalate into an all-out war?
Unfortunately, the media in our country, the Tamil media, 90% of the media, whether electronic or print, you see, is supportive of the LTT because they are backed by the LTT for some reason or other. Maybe out of fear, or maybe they are financed, or maybe any other reason not known to me. So the media is always finding fault with the forces, you see, and glorifying the LTT. I can give you just one instance. The radio and TV is giving the news from the Tamil media that UN representative Alan Rock, who had condemned or found fault with the government for helping the breakaway Karuna group, you see, to recruit child soldiers. But I told him, it's not brought like this, but I think he would have certainly mentioned that also. I told him, everyone talks about the conscription and other violent acts, you see, in the government-held area. But no one talks about the things that are happening within the LTT held area, which is like some iron curtain area, where there is darkroom chambers, detention camps, torture camps, abductions. There have been so many abductions by the LTT. This is not brought out. But I am sure he would have, in his report, he would have mentioned this also. But the Tamil media didn't bother to say anything about that. Only repeatedly condemning the government forces for supporting or helping Karna to conscript children. Is the most unfortunate thing today in our country.
Do you sometimes feel that your life is in danger because you are a moderate and you do not hesitate to criticise the Tamil Tigers? I mean, have they threatened you?
Oh, yes, I am facing grave risk, you see. I am aware of that. But I always take up the position that as a citizen of Sri Lanka, I have a duty by our people, no, to have them liberated. I personally feel that the people who are living in Kilinochi and other areas that are under the control of the LTT are living like slaves. They have no independence. They have no fundamental rights. They have no democratic rights. The whole, the entire international community is not fully aware of this.
Do you think that both the LTTE and the Sri Lankan government think that only a military solution to the ethnic conflict is possible?
Winning a war is not possible. The only way is for the government to come out with a solution that should be reasonable enough for the international community to recommend it as good or reasonable for the Tamil people to accept. After that, the LTT can be dealt with in many ways.
But how hopeful are you that this will happen, and that there will be a meaningful peace deal that can, you know, substitute the one that basically has now riddled with holes?
It will have to happen very soon. Because now the most encouraging thing that is happening in Sri Lanka is two major political parties that had been ruling the country by turns, you see, for during the last 50 years of this ethnic issue. For the first time, both of them are trying to find a solution within a united Sri Lanka on a federal constitution. The presidential candidate of the UNP went to polls, you see, with the offer of a federal solution, and he polled 49.7%. That means 49.7% of the Sinhalese people are agreeable for a solution based on the federal structure. On the other hand, the President's party, the Sri Lanka Freedom Party, another major political party, that too had passed unanimously a resolution to find a solution based on the federal constitution. So I think we are very, very close to a solution. I am very optimistic. I think that will happen. And the two committees that had been appointed by these two political parties meet often, and they have agreed to work on a common program. And their priority is the ethnic issue. So it all depends on how the LTT takes it, or how the LTT is pressurized to accept a reasonable solution within a united Sri Lanka based on the federal constitution. In my view, I am very, very, very hopeful. If the LTT will accept, they declare that they are prepared to accept a federal solution is in hand.
So in the meantime, you are going to be continuing to preach the virtues of tolerance and a non-violent solution to the problems of your homeland.
Yeah, I continue to fulfill my mission. That is why I say I am hopeful that without a war, my talks, you see, the government can find a solution. Now the LTT will have to adjust itself. Whoever can bring pressure on the LTT to accept a solution based on the federal structure, without shedding one drop of blood from today, we can find a solution to the problem.
And that was Vera Singham, Anada Sangari, who has just won the UNESCO Prize for the Promotion of Tolerance and Nonviolence. He was speaking there to my colleague Susie Hodges. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.